Blog Talk Radio.
Koda, Mojuba, Asheda, Mojuba, Aluwa, Mi, Apolabi, Pega, Mojuba, Araba, Mi, Adesanya, Awuyade, Mojuba, Ogute, Compound, Ode, Remo, Mojuba, Baba, Mojuba, Yeye, Mojuba, Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba, Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba, Egungun, to all the chiefs, Mojuba, Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba, Egungun, to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe-o.
This is from the pamphlet, 25 Years a Slave, a Pennsylvania prisoner's appeal to the people for freedom. This is entitled The Letter to the People by Asafo Chuma Asafo from Huntington Penitentiary in Pennsylvania, USA. Dear people, I am speaking these words to y'all from the confines of one of Pennsylvania's most dreadful neo-plantations. But with an untethered heart and an unchained mind, and in the flesh and spirit of my true African self, and not as the colonial subject my captors wishes me to be, with a psalm meditation that my honorable ancestors will guide my voice and aid in the escape of these words, smuggling them not only past these cell bars, barbed wire fences, gun towers, and state-hired goons, but also the artificial barriers, stigmas, and stereotypes constructed by today's slave makers to maintain their age-old tactic of divide and conquer as it pertains to their efforts to cut the modern-day enslaved off from the rest of the world, especially from you, the people. I am, again, a Safo Chuma Safo. However, on all government paperwork relevant to my incarceration / enslavement and other state documents, I am known by the colonial name Robert Williams, a name I have openly denounced in favor of the former. I have been in state captivity for more than 25 years on a trumped-up second-degree murder conviction. I was 19 years old when I was captured, charged, and led away in chains by the modern paddy rollers and subjected to one state internment camp after another, where I have pretty much grown up. I never got the chance to experience a quote-unquote normal life, including one of the most fundamental tenets of being human, which is to have children. With the exception of a fistful of committed family and friends, I have grown accustomed to people bouncing in and out of my life with no real permanence, a precarious circumstance no doubt attributed to my protracted captivity. People, these words aren't to elicit any undue pity, nor are they an attempt to paint myself with the brush of a saint. My formative years were honed in the streets of Philadelphia, replete with all of their dirty elements. So much of what the streets say I did, I'll be the first to affirm. In the words and spirit of honorable ancestor Amilcar Cabral, quote, mask no difficulties, claim no easy victories, and tell no lies to the people, end quote. So I come to you with both hands exposed, palms up, with remnants of grit still in the cracks. But I assure you, I still have my honor, my integrity, and more importantly, my African soul. And to the dismay of my captors, I have been redeemed by Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad, Queen Mother Moore, Dr. Amos Wilson, and ilk. I would like to read to you an excerpt from the book entitled Slavery Here and Now. Contrary to popular belief that the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 actually ended slavery for Africans here in North America, it has not. And although it has taken on more subtle variations to suit the changing times and trends, an honest examination of the enduring powerless lot of African peoples would certainly lend credence to the familiar maxim, the more things change, the more they remain the same. Sure, the chains were removed from the hands and feet of captured Africans, but they were alternately placed on their minds, thus choreographing their prescribed behavior within the broader American society. However, when it comes to the mass incarceration of African men, women, and children within what has become widely referred to as the prison industrial complex, we see the continuum of chattel slavery, concealed, of course, behind the rubric of crime and punishment. The term criminal itself is a loaded handle, wielded by white power holders to perpetuate the imprisonment or enslavement of Africans, enshrined within his more ubiquitous phrase, law and order. A phrase interpreted by many of us Africans in the context of its dual functioning as it adversely affects us versus European Americans to mean our systematic entrapment. And given what Earl O'Ferry Hutchinson has so fittingly termed, and I quote, the assassination of the black male image, end quote, by the biased corporate-owned media machine, the spurious social sciences, and the manipulated religious interpretations which painted God in the image of a European while deeming Africans cursed and thus worthy of an eternal status of inferiority, gives us an historical foundation for the ways and means by which the politics of race are being played out in the now times, especially as it pertains to the criminalization of Africans. In her eye-opening treatise, The New Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander very cogently explains how an entire nation of captured Africans can be wantonly, maliciously, and deliberately targeted for mass incarceration and subsequently relegated to a permanent undercaste status here in the land of the free. by laws, statutes, and policies that appear race neutral on their face, while being enforced in lieu of a sinister political agenda that ultimately serves the aims and objectives of this ivory-coated empire called America, at the expense of those people the white oppressor have always considered to be, in the words of warrior scholar Marimba Ani, the cultural other. In this vein, Alexander's study succeeds in peeling back the veil of color blindness, revealing with empirical data, the bulk of which was gleaned from the state's own archives, not only the racist and biased ways in which the laws are still being applied to the cultural other, but how the state's economy, power dynamics, status quo, much like the Jim Crow era of old, is dependent upon this new version, which we're faced with today, so much so that it cannot turn itself around. It therefore reinvents itself in different guises in an attempt to evade scrutiny while shrouding itself in colorblind rhetoric, which itself is monopolized, that is, framed, controlled, and contextualized by the state in terms of when and how racial matters should be presented, discussed, or handled in the society at large, but especially so within the political law and order realm. But once we decode the Greco-Latin legal jargon and remove the esoteric mask as to how it protects white rule while conversely subjugating African peoples, it reveals the naked face of its hypocrisy. Take, for example, the term emancipate, which is said to mean to set free. However, when traced back to its origins, we learn that it is a term taken from old Roman legalese. It really means transfer of ownership. So African captives were never truly set free. We were merely transferred from private property status to state-owned property, which later became known as assumable jurisdiction. Hell, the emancipator himself, Abraham Lincoln, during his political debates with political opponent, Stephen Douglas, declared, and I quote, "There must be an inferior and a superior. I, as much as any man, am in favor of superior being assigned to the white race," end quote. So when we look at the systematic condemnation, demonization, and subsequent criminalization of Africans through the prism of the double-edged 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which reads, and I quote, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction," end quote. It brings into clearer focus the rise and proliferation of the day's new slave plantations, euphemistically called correctional facilities. In fact, it is no empty coincidence that just after the close of the Civil War of April 1865, Africans in America's prisons immediately went from zero to over 30%. African prisoners were then subject to the brutal convict lease system, where forced-free prison labor was leased out to plantation owners and other industrial barons, filling the coffers of prison wardens in the state's respective treasuries, an arrangement described in David M. Oshinsky's titled book as Worse Than Slavery. Fast forward to the now times, and as we can see, the three fastest-growing industries are the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, and the surveillance-industrial complex, all working in concert to more efficiently maintain the colonization, surveillance, and imprisonment or enslavement of the ghettos and their African denizens, not excluding poor whites. Each state's court system serves as the new slave owners, a system driven by coded policies with elected politicians performing in the capacity of modern-day slave traders, the police apparatus acting as today's slave hunters or catchers. America's jails and prisons are, of course, the new slave plantations, where forced cheap prison labor is in full force. Prison industrial sweatshops throughout the United States produce everything from car parts to pillowcases and much in between, which are matriculated into the wider consumer market flow at great profits. Prisoners are also sacrificed at the altar of the exploitation at the hands of rapacious private sector profiteers, namely telephone companies, transportation services, prison commissary vendors, money order wire transfer firms, cable companies, etc., 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 with handsome kickbacks paid to the prisonocracy. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, a state which holds some 50,000 men, women, and children behind the walls and fences of its new plantations, have a unique history being one of the original 13 colonies, it is steeped in the rich tradition of chattel slavery, a tradition that is alive and thriving as we speak. The very emblem on the Commonwealth flag, which flies over every municipal building and every single prison and jail in the state of Pennsylvania and stamped atop all official state charters, is an old and persistent symbol of slavery. It was originally used in the South to identify legitimate auction blocks where European American males sold and traded captured African men, women, and children. It also represented a bill of sales. If you look closely between the two raised horses, you will see a slave ship, which represents the trafficking in human cargo. Just beneath the slave ship is a farm hoe, which signifies the labor of the enslaved on the many plantations as the backbone of the state's economy. The three bales of cotton, wheat, and tobacco represent the principal crops that enrich the slave master society. The eagle or vulture that sits at the very top represents insatiable greed. These emblems or coat of arms are still used today on all uniforms and documents that it continues to perpetuate this modern form of slavery. The Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, or PADOC, the courts, DAs, lawyers, parole and probation, etc., all use the symbol to signify that they are continuing the original plantation business, only in a slightly different and more accepted form. Again, that was a piece by Asafo Chumasafo from the pamphlet 25 Years Enslaved, Pennsylvania Prisoners' Appeal to the People for Freedom. I'd like to thank Patricia, Mama Pat Vickers, Teresa Schultz, the Warrior, Sandra the Nahanda Hill, Brett Grote, who is quickly becoming our generation's William Kunstler, and certainly PrisonRadio.org, Noel.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Here with Sign of the Times Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by New Power Radio Network, and I'm interviewing Brother Safir Chuma Asafo. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Asafo Chuma Asafo.
Okay, okay. Chuma Asafo.
If the fear was a numb diploma I was using some time ago, but same person, you know.
Ashe. And what meaning does Asafo have?
Asafo, that's our clan name. Of course, it's rooted in our history and our traditions. Coming out of West Africa, Asafo means warrior scholar or warrior people, you know.
Ashe.
We are at war, so... We are in the third trimester of our Ma'afa, which is the war phase. So it's only fitting that we have made, you know, telling of the times we are in, you know.
Mhm. So tell us a little bit about you and what inspired you to write this letter to the people.
Okay. I'm formerly Robert Williams from Philly, West Philly. Been incarcerated here in Pennsylvania for the last 28 years come March the 11th for a second-degree murder conviction, an erroneous second-degree murder conviction. That letter to the people is actually a portion of a pamphlet that I put out or that I intend to put out soon for the masses called 25 Years of Slave, the Pennsylvania Prisoners Appeal to the People for Freedom. So instead of a typical introduction, I used an open letter to the people to sort of introduce myself, my situation, especially when making a bold claim like, you know, enslaved. A lot of people don't make the correlation between imprisonment and enslavement. I mean, well, nowadays, these things starting to come to the fore with the 13th and the 13th Amendment, that kind of stuff being elucidated by a lot of mainstream folk now. But that's sort of the gist of that.
All right. Now, looking at the issue of mass incarceration, which is something that we have discussed here all the time. We've engaged with the Free Alabama Movement on several broadcasts. And one of the things that we always stress to our listeners is that there's a difference between what history has told us about slavery and the actual act of what we know as modern-day slavery with mass incarceration and the enslavement of our people. Can you talk about what you've experienced? You were arrested and sentenced at the age of 19 And after 20-some-odd years, what have you noticed that is the difference between when you were first imprisoned and what we see now, and what the public can do to show more of a human face to mass incarceration and the modern-day, I guess, slavery that we're experiencing as a group of people?
Well, we can see a direct correlation between, just looking at the broad perspective, of globalism and mass incarceration. You know, now everything is being concentrated now. And so because of that, you know, everybody's situation is becoming more desperate. So as a method, in terms of the politics of crime, a method to manage people's lives, these prisons are not necessarily prisons in the so-called traditional sense. They are management centers for poor people. So this is what they're using to manage the lives of people. I mean, when you look at the ankle bracelets, being on the street, halfway houses, parole, all those things. You wipe away the bullshit, you can see, if I'm allowed to say that, right? when you wipe that away, you can actually see the continuum of slavery. Now, those things are easily discernible now. They have taken off the velvet glove off the iron fist, and they're showing you. It's funny how a lot of people literally didn't even know about the 13th Amendment. You know, obviously it's not new. I mean, what is December 6, 1865? Shoot. And so now those correlations are beginning to be made. Another element of the mass incarceration thing now is, you know, the privatization of prisons, the money to be made, the private sector is cashing in, you know, commissary vendors, you know, their connection to private companies, you know, Martha Stewart, you know, they even have people making products for them in these joints. So it is big business now, and ostensibly so, you know, on the stock market, you know, the whole time. Now that these things are being brought to the fore, especially by other countries, you know what I mean? Because, you know, America, they call other countries up on their human rights violations. So now they're starting to reflect the mirror back on them. What about yours?
Mm-hmm.
Now they have the answer for that. And so since they do, now the rhetoric has become criminal justice reform. And so this is the era that we're in. And since we are in this era, it gives birth to these kind of discussions, making it to the mainstream. You know, you're hearing entertainment folk and all that kind of stuff talking about this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I think we need to seize on that momentum and try to straighten this out. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, one of the things that when I was a child, I remember my grandmother going to visit my cousin in the northern part of Ohio, and having that connection to your family as you are serving your time. And one of the things that sticks out to me the most is that it seems as though crime and punishment is more stress in the form of correction than it is rehabilitation. And that was, you know, my understanding from the time that I was a child. The purpose of the justice system was to, okay, you know, somebody, you know, made a mistake, intentionally, unintentionally, whatever, something happened, a crime was committed, and they went and served their time and come out and at least came away with some sort of skill or something they could use educationally to help truly rehabilitate them, to truly make them a better person than they were when they went in. What are the current opportunities that are needed and that should be there if really rehabilitation was the key versus correction? You know, explain what it's like in that environment so people can understand why it's important to gain more advocacy when it comes to speaking truth to power and addressing this issue.
Well, right now, in these joints, as I said, they're management centers. And so the less money that they can, less money that they have to put into this, the better for them, because it has become ostensibly big business. You know, many years ago, they said Pell Grants, college courses, things like that, where you could gain an education that's, you know, pliable when you go home. Nowadays, those things are absent. You know, a little while ago, I watched a program, 60 Minutes, and they was highlighting prisons in several other countries. One of the countries they was going through extensively was Germany.
Mm-hmm.
John Wetzel, who was the Secretary of Corrections of Pennsylvania, was present with this delegation going to check out their prisons. So it had shown, it showed that they was like pro-rehabilitation. It was an interview of murderers that was literally sitting in public parks down the street from the prison, still being on the prison roster, so to speak. And they was using it to show them that this was a part of the program. One of the things I noticed is those were like German nationals. When you look at America, we're not considered American, you know, for real, in terms of black folks, you know, making up 12 or 13% of the population of the country. 58-64% of the prison population, so we understand what that is. We, you know what I mean? So these things are not a mystery. So them rehabilitating us or reforming us is sort of like a joke. And that joke has sort of, you know, come to the fore now. So now, like I said, they have taken off the velvet glove. Now it is what it is. You know, we're seeing raw torture. You know, we're seeing, like, look at California. You know what I mean? You know, for trying to rehabilitate yourself from reading certain information like George Jackson, other Pan-African information to get you locked out of the hole. So what is reform? You know, does reform mean we reform you into a good citizen where you don't challenge the powers that be? So what is reform? This has given birth to hunger strikes everywhere. I mean, look at the Free Alabama movement. I mean, how they was working these brothers like slaves. They refused to parole them because they was producing this kind of thing. This is what it has become, and this is what the public need to know. These are not rehabilitation centers. They're management centers. We will manage you. We will feed you minimally. You know what I mean? We will give you minimal and release you back into the streets, being monitored. You know what I mean? America is becoming a police state, really. This is what we have to prepare ourselves for. It's good that we do have this movement to highlight this, but eventually we're going to have to become a little bit more sagacious in how we move in terms of moving for our own self, moving for our independence. It's coming to that.
Absolutely. And we know that just disproportionately black males are affected both by the school-to-prison pipeline. When it comes to the school-to-prison pipeline, when it comes to mass incarceration, you know, they're really taking our brothers away from us, and to a certain extent leaving, you know, not only us as women vulnerable to society, to the politics and the civic ills of our community, but also our young black men. And so can you talk about, you know, when you speak about the assassination of the black male image, what does that mean, and how do you stay focused and inspired, you know, behind enemy lines?
I guess from certain warrior scholars. I mean, when you look at Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X being a salient figure in this, since he was a prisoner, he proactively educated himself. So a lot of us has chosen that model. You look at George Jackson, who proactively educated himself, and not just any old education, but like a real political education. Like an elder once told a war veteran, Joshua Sadi, he said, whenever you're at war and you smell that cordite in the air, you know, gunshots ringing around you, he said it makes you question, why the hell am I here? You know what I mean? You know, everything seemed well in a theoretical sense. But once you are literally on a battlefield, you begin to question even who sent you. You know, your country, your president, did he lie? What is this really about? And so this is one of the things that soldiers grapple with in real war. When you look at prisons, it makes you think, when you sit here for protracted amounts of time, why am I really here? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because obviously I didn't come out my mother's womb the way they have depicted me. And so because if I did, that would mean that my mother's womb is corrupt. And if my mother's womb is corrupt, it means Mother Africa is corrupt. We less alive. So what are the politics of crime? What are the politics of the circumstance that led to me making the choice that I made? Or even, was it my choice?
Uh-huh.
Was I really under societal coercion? You know, did they have these spots designated for us? And did we begin to fill these roles? You know, one of the things Amos Wilson points out to us is the making of the criminal. You know, how do you make a black criminal? I mean, how do you cause one to see himself in the light that you have cast him in? You know, you convince him to believe that he is who you have projected him to be. And so all these things are part of the process. But in digging these things up, what you do is you uncover a bigger hypocrisy. And America doesn't want to deal with the hypocrisy. Hell, a lot of blacks don't even want to deal with that hypocrisy because mm-hmm. it draws the line in the sand. All this shit is a farce. You know what I mean? So we still stick to these other lines, you know, so that we don't upset the apple cart, as they say. But if we really want to get into the nitty-gritty of this, I mean, it's really, really deep. But we have to start with the politics that's rooted in racism, is rooted in the cultural divergence of us versus them. That's how deep it gets. You know, that'll take us into Marimba, Anis, Yorugu, you know, if we get that deep.
I'll say.
But that's truly how deep it is, you know what I mean? So, you know, it'll take us to, some time to uncover these layers. But I do think we are on the right course. We are on course because a lot of times you do have to peel the layers. A lot of us can see the core, you know what I mean, you know, right beneath the layers. We don't need to peel them. But a lot of times we have to peel them for people so that they can see. A lot of times it's time-consuming. Here it is. I'm coming up 28th year behind this wall. And things are moving slow. Things are promising, but they're moving slow. But a lot mm-hmm. of people have to catch on gradually, so I have to be patient right along with people. So that's where we are now.
Ashe, what message would you have for any young black males that may be listening who, you know, may or may not have had an experience with the judicial system or the police? And what can you say to them to express how important it is that they educate themselves, not only, you know, what they learn in school, but on a comprehensive level so that they can be the men that we need in our community?
Well, I think certainly education, as you can say, but a particular education, education of the politics of our existence. And within that framework, you will see everything for what it really is, even the systematic entrapment. So that's important. But as a part of that, to be connected, you know, sometimes to prevent you from coming to prison, you might have to connect with someone in prison. And the reason why I say that is because when you look at history, our history shows that we have been cut off from our elders. We're talking about the Mutulu Shakurs, the Suliata Colts, the Russell Maroon Schultzes. These are not criminals. These are true bona fide revolutionaries who have been criminalized and placed in these camps all over the country, their political prisons. And so since we were cut off from them, and our political education has been stunted, that's why we're learning these things belatedly. We're supposed to know about the politics of our environment. How do we not know that? You know, you go among any other people, you can talk to a 7-year-old Palestinian boy, and he can tell you the politics of why he's throwing a rock at an Israeli tank. But we don't know the politics of our imprisonment because they have a cultural continuum. They know who their elders are, their elder school them. These things are being discussed at their dinner tables, the politics of their poverty. But ours are not being discussed. And those who are have the capability of discussing, of elucidating, are the ones who was cut off from us. This is how we wind up with Scarface movies, coming into the 80s after they have cut us off from our elders. is how we wound up emulating Nino Brown. These things are not by happenstance. You know, it's politics and movies, politics and entertainment. So we run around, we want to be everyone but our revolutionary. Take a stroll through Ireland. You see Michael Collins. You see Jerry Adams of the Sinn Féin, the IRA, their heroes painted on their walls in their neighborhood. In our neighborhoods, we want to be like Mike, right? You know, we are given our heroes, right? Because they demonize our heroes, our true heroes, our political prisoners. They demonize them. They demonize the Panther Party and put them in a criminal light. So that's a partner problem. So what I would tell young brothers is to literally seek that out. Seek out information that's sort of off the grid because it could save your life. When I put this pamphlet out, this pamphlet is not just my pamphlet. This is our story. I'm telling the story of a young black man, a typical young black man. I was your typical young black man from the hood, trying to make good. Come from a family like all my peers, mama alcoholic, father alcoholic. I mean, we boosted to eat, you know, typical shit. Not understanding the politics of imprisonment, the politics of our poverty. You know, I didn't understand that until then. And so now that's why I'm putting this pamphlet out to sort of elucidate that whole history, to give you a brief snapshot. That's a starting point.
Ashe. Now, we, as you said earlier, there's a lot of emphasis being placed on the 13th Amendment and whether, you know, slavery was ever really, quote-unquote, emancipated from the United States Constitution. Talk about the importance of abolishing the 13th Amendment and how have we been bamboozled into thinking that we had truly ever been set free? What things happened in history that we should have paid closer attention to, that we just took for granted that folks were going to do the right thing?
Wow. That's a hell of a question, right? And it's a funny one. I'm laughing because, hold on 1 second, police here. Yes. I'm laughing because it's sort of like, the white man came to me right now, told me I was going home, right? You know, pull some papers out. Now, of course, you know me, I'm jumping at it. But on the other side of that paper that it said is being free, you know, it might be I had to give up my first 3 children, right? I didn't read the fine print, right? Because I'm just on my way out the door, you know what I mean? So that's sort of like that thing, right? And then you figure in the moment, who can anticipate this? You know what I mean? Like just think 1863, going into 1865, coming out of the Civil War era. Who can anticipate when y'all saying that I can leave off this plantation, that y'all would reinvent the plantation in the form of the correction facility, right? And then that this 13th Amendment has this double-edged, this duplicitous clause. You know, just think of that. Now this thing is being brought to bear. So now, since it has been reinvented, now we're looking at it in that light. You know, like I said, belatedly. You know what I mean? And so then when you talk about abolishing it, you know, we have to understand that white folks are addicted to this. You know what I mean? That's why it constantly reinvents itself in different guises. You know what I mean? So they can hide behind certain things while they continue to practice the same thing and then deceive us into thinking that we have made progress. Mind you, a lot of our own people have been absorbed into their system. And so it doesn't seem so bad. You know what I mean? We got a bunch of black folk. You know what I mean? Like, after all, we just had a black president, right? You know? So they use them as sort of like the gray buffer, you know what I mean, to justify other things. You know what I mean? It's just prolonging time. One of the things that I've come to realize is white folks are sincere. You know, we tend to underestimate. They mean this. We think they're being evil. This is deeper than evil. I mean, this is their nature. They mean what they do.
Mm-hmm.
It's us who haven't gotten the historical memo. I mean, so our organization's against the 13th Amendment. That's just a shortstop, because a lot of these things are just little small band-aids and necessary ones so that we can make room to have harder discussions about our independence, because that's what it's going to come to. Because if 500-600 years haven't taught us that we have to get the fuck away from these people, then what will? You know,
mm-hmm.
So the 13th Amendment, you know, in terms of moving to abolish, is the start, if for no other reason than a rallying point to rally us together around that issue, so that we can sort of take that as a flash point and move, you know, further. So if for nothing else, it could serve that.
Ashe, thank you for that. And so let's talk about Asafo a little more. I know that, you know, you said that you were convicted, and the case was a trumped-up case, and you are not the only one who is being punished for a crime that they truly did not commit. I want to ask you, and you can go into as much or as little detail about your case as you feel comfortable with, but what would make you whole at this point, considering that your conviction was questionable? We talk about reparative and restorative justice. What would make you whole again?
What would make me whole?
Yeah, what would justice look like for you?
Justice for me would actually be pretty simple in my individualistic case. In my case, actually, I never claimed complete innocence. In my case, in Pennsylvania, the law is a little different than other states. In Pennsylvania, a first-degree murder is life. Second-degree murder is life, which is actually an illegal sentence. Right? There's a distinction between the two. I mean, I guess the distinction would be, according to their laws, would be that every sentence has to have a minimum and maximum.
Mm-hmm.
The maximum for first degree would be death. The minimum would be life. Second degree, the minimum is life, maximum is life, which makes it an illegal sentence. Third degree, 20 to 40, so on and so forth. With my particular sentence, I was convicted of killing a guy. I tried to expel a guy from the apartment of a former girlfriend. They had converted her spot into a crack cocaine manufacturing and packaging spot. She had children there. Tried to get the guy to leave. One thing led to another. Guy get killed. Okay, I admit that much. Where it gets tricky is when they say I committed a robbery. All the witnesses testified that I never robbed him. But they say that that was my intention, of course. So since it was my intention, because they have to have a motive for the murder, So the motive was robbery, right? The witnesses didn't initially admit that they were selling crack cocaine out of the house, of course not, right? And so that got me a second degree. My argument was that I should have had either a third degree or less, which would have rendered me maxed out by then. I would have been maxed out 8 years ago. Under the old, if I got convicted of third degree, I'd have had 10 to 20, about 28. So I'd have been home 8 years with a maximum. I'd have been home 18 years ago on the minimum. So that's my argument in this particular case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so is it too late to appeal? Is there anything that we can do to support you?
I have an appeal in, right? It's crazy because now we come to the politics of it. In the early years, appealing my case, I was appealing it purely from a legal standpoint. You know what I mean? The law says this, and so-and-so says this, and the court procedures, you know, law, court procedures, there's the rule of court procedure. And, of course, they violated much of that. So I found these little things and sort of highlighted them in my appeal and highlighted, you know, the fact that I never robbed someone, these kind of things. And I didn't understand the politics of it. So I'm thinking these people got to give me justice. This is my naivety initially. You know, these people's going to straighten this out. You know what I mean? You know, they were, every time they sent me a pill back, denied, denied. I'm wondering, well, what the hell? They don't even adhere to their own shit, you know. Then when I begin to hear people like Russell Maroon Schultz, I start running to these elders, these homes in these prisons around the state. They begin to help me understand these things from a political perspective. Once I understood that, I said, oh, okay, this is not about right and wrong. This is purely about power. They have the power to say you're right, you're wrong. Okay. So now I begin to approach my case politically, the politics of it. This is, thus, this is why we're having this interview, you know, to elucidate the politics of it. You know what I mean? To get it out into the public so that the public can begin to demand these things. Like, why are y'all holding this guy based on bus and bus? You know, it's sort of like sometimes when I watch 60 Minutes, 48 Hours, Hard Copy, you know, 2020, they always investigate cases, mainly white folks. You know, murder mystery guy killed his wife or whatever, you know. We're going to get to the bottom of this. We don't have them luxuries, because if I was on 2020, I would be home. If they was to piece my case apart, they'd be like, oh, my God, this is absurd. Granted, he said he did this, he said he did that. 19-year-old kid, you know, the whole scenario. But we don't have them luxuries, and so we have to play the long hand, you know what I mean? So one of the things that I'm doing is I'm trying to get my case out there in this way, so that when people hear it, people can begin to question it. Because, you know, to understand that these DAs are elected officials, so the people have the power to hold them to this. What about this? What about that? You know what I mean? And I point these things out in the pamphlet that I'm putting out. I have a section in there where I actually go through these little details of my case so that the public can see how I was handled versus how others are handled. You know what I mean? You know how white folks are handled, you know. So that's, you know, just to understand the politics of it. So that's one of the things that I'm putting forth now. I have an appeal in that. As a part of my appeal is that I was 19 years old when I come in. As we know, they just ruled 2012 Montgomery versus Alabama. No, not Montgomery. The Alabama case. I think it's Miller versus Alabama. Then 2016 case, Montgomery versus Louisiana, where they made that ruling retroactive in terms of parole eligibility for juveniles. The language is talking about from 18 and under. The Pennsylvania Constitution says you are a minor up until you're 21. Based upon that in the Pennsylvania Constitution, I filed an appeal on that. I haven't heard anything yet. A lot of the so-called legal pundits have said, well, it's not 18 and under, so it don't count. So my thing is, do you suspend the Pennsylvania Constitution? Is it suspended? Because if it's suspended in that instance, then it's suspended in every other instance that was used to convict me.
Right.
Well, the rules and procedures in which y'all conducted these mock hearings, you know what I mean? You go through my lynching, so to speak, right? And also, there's a case out of Illinois, Antonio House, the People versus House, where he was 19 years old, former gang member, gangster disciple, double homicide, killed two guys, they gave life. He appealed to saying, I was 19. Y'all Constitution, Illinois Constitution says thus and thus. They looked at the Constitution and said, you're correct, and resentenced. So the notion that Pennsylvania can't do the same, that they're beholden, but that they're constrained, you know, by the Supreme Court language, that's false, because Illinois moved to rectify the sentence for Antonio House. So I'm using all of that in this particular appeal to, you know, sort of get that off the ground. So that's a part of it. Also, several witnesses have come forth to say we lied about the robbery. He never robbed this guy. So that's a part of the appeal. Yes. So, and it's been, my appeal has been sitting in there since March of last year. I received a letter from a woman named Helen Levin of Defenders Association of Philadelphia. So what they did was they created this database where they had already pitched for the rest of the juvenile, but they're using the neuroscience report, which broke this whole thing open for juvenile. They're saying that from 18 to 25, you know, we got to up the age. This is what they're saying. It's a hell of a shot, but they're playing it. But she was telling me that one of the reasons why they probably held up on responding to my appeal to them now is to review all these other cases.
Uh-huh.
I mean, so they sort of, you know, hoping, you know, have some type of optimism about this whole juvenile thing and them upping it, because several other states have upped their juvenile age from 18 to 20, some to 21. I forget the states exactly, about two or three states, a European country up their age to 22. All this is based upon this neuroscience report. So I'm saying, if you're a juvenile in California, you know, up to your 20, if you're a juvenile in Missouri, how can you not be one in Pennsylvania? You know, that kind of thing. So
that's right.
Stuff, just, yeah, to point out the absurdity of it all. So that's the course we're on now. But the pamphlet will be out so that people can be, you know, it's pretty much a donation for the pamphlet. It'll be maybe, you know, if Amazon will have it in a minute, so we get it all uploaded on the PDF, transferred to their CreateSpace. It'll be maybe $5.99, you know. And, you know, the funds from that will help with legal fees and things like that. So that's what we have with it.
Ashe. Now, how can people, you know, reach out to you, support you, if they want to make a contribution? How should they do that?
Yes, yes. In fact, there's something else that's being set up through my brother, the one that contacted you. But you can certainly get with me on Facebook. You know, I mean, I'm pretty active on there, right? Robert Asafo Williams. Right. You can also get with Vic Petals on Facebook. These things that we just start to put in place today, because we're working from behind the wall, literally. You know what I'm saying?
Ashe. So, you know, I want to ask you two more questions, if you don't mind. One, you used the term prisonocracy, which I found to be intriguing. So can you talk about what that term means and explain it to the listener?
Okay, prisonocracy. That's sort of a play upon the words, compounding the words prison, bureaucracy. You know what I mean? Because these things are sort of invented, sort of encoded now. You know what I mean? These things have become literal departments unto themselves. You know, these things have become working, functioning, gigantic entity, you know, and then there's and all these processes that you deal with in slavery. You know what I mean? They have us cloaked behind prison numbers, a whole dossier that criminalizes you to the oomph degree. You know what I mean? You know, have this whole process of demonization, you know, this, you know, beginning before you even get here, beginning with the assassination of the black male image, you know what I mean, the condemnation of your blackness, you know,
mm-hmm.
starting in those realms, you know what I mean, and, you know, as we know, white folk view science, religion, and everything, you know, we cursed, you know, we are genetically inferior, you know, we are. You know, we have a natural propensity or proclivity toward crime, you know, especially of the violent variety, you know, they have us dressed up. And so
mm-hmm.
these prisons literally validate that. You know, they validate that. So these things have become, you know, prisonocracy. You know, people on the other side of that, people, their careers are built upon us, on our backs. I mean, judges, you know, running for, you know, a higher office based upon their convictions and how they got them. You know, we have instances where judges down in Lackawanna County had deals, secret deals. deals, financial deals with the owners, the private owners of juvenile facilities, where they would just send us more juveniles, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we will give you a kickback. So, you know, it's essentially selling folks' children to juvenile facilities for money, live and direct, you know, convicted and all that. So these are the things that spells, you know, prisonocracy. You know, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And I appreciate and respect that explanation. It's a good one. And so you don't mind if I use it, do you?
No, it's not mine. You know, in fact, everything I say belongs to the people. Nothing belongs to me. I learned these things.
Ashe. Well, you know, as we get ready to wrap up, the last thing I wanted to hear from you is, you know, you can tell just by listening to your testimony, the letter to the people, and the fact that you've committed to helping to uplift our people through educating them on, you know, not only what happened to you, but the system as a whole. But we've got a lot of mending to do in our community. We have been a nation of people who have suffered beyond any of that comparative to a lot of other places, considering the amount of time that we have been here and been a part of this so-called society here in the U.S. So in the mealing and mending and healing that needs to take place, what advice do you have for us so that we can problem solve a lot more easier so that we can allow for that healing to take place and rebuild the bridges that may have been burned at one point in time, because we definitely need each other. We're stronger together than we ever have been apart. So I'd like to get your response on that.
Wow, that's an excellent question, Ron. In fact, it's one that myself, along with other brothers that I walk these yards with, grapple with, we speak about, right? Because as we have matured, especially my brothers that have been here for many seasons, as we have matured and we look at our children and our friends' children come here, we watch a whole cycle of sort of self-annihilation, if you will, take a place. And so growing, you know, because not only politicized, but growing more culturally aware. I mean, that's what you're gonna, that opens the door for your natural love for your people.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing it through that lens deeply saddens me. And so, since it does, a lot of what we have done is we have begun to look at other models. You know, for example, when you look at South Africa, Truth Reconciliation, it's a good brother by the name of Gani. Gani is at another prison here in Pennsylvania. He's a juvenile life. He's lifting his case up now to decide what to do with him because he refused to take this astronomical deal they tried to offer. But anyway, he has a nice program called, if I can think of it, or something. I believe it's an acronym or something. I can't get it right off the head. But he's hooked up with a professor named Mike Lyons down in St. Joe's University, and what they're doing is bringing families there, victims' families there, and then a lot of brothers call in so we can speak to them from prison to, number one, apologize for our egregious conduct in our own communities, and not the lame apology that's expected of you to be received, but the real apology, the real contrite, real remorse. You know, the part of it is to tell the truth. I mean, what did I do? You know what I mean? Because you can't apologize if you admit to what it is that you done.
Mm-hmm.
To consciously acknowledge that. So that's one form, and that's a model that could be picked up, and it could take on various incarnations, have different prongs added to it, right, to be defined. When you look at Mr. Lewis Farrakhan, for example, I mention him because he has a certain credibility in the black community. you know, whenever rappers are feeling, as we've seen over the years, you can go to Mr. Farrakhan and sort of have a safe haven, a safe sit down where he will give wisdom, you know what I mean, to the situation without you necessarily compromising your street credibility, as they call it, right? So to have credible people in our hood who are impartial arbiters, you know what I mean, respected elders, these are starts. You know, we can come to them and we can resolve issues, this kind of stuff. And these methods are literally rooted in our tradition. Traditional African society, we had problems with one another. You know what I mean? We had models of resolving them. So just going back into our tradition, because you figure it's not that they didn't work, it's just that we have been taken from them, or they have been taken from us. And one of the things that Yoruba have done to us in terms of the black community is they have eroded, and I mean greatly eroded, our sense of trust. So one of the things that I have tried to stand up now is be a man of my word, to me that my apology is sincere. I have tried to deal with people like straight up and down. And I think I have built up a level of credibility for myself over the years, you know, being here even with brothers on the street that I commune with, that my word is good. You know what I mean? The best thing to say that in the African tradition is that your mouth is made sweet. You know what I mean? Meaning that your words are credible. You know what I mean? And your words, you know, as we know in the traditional African, you know, society or in our traditions period, there's no contradiction between what we think, say, and do. But the reality is there is contradiction to what we think, say, and do. So our mission is to bridge that gap between what we think, say, and do. So that's a growth period. So I think, you know, going along them lines, we can have some healing, but we have to really, really come to this, and we have to really seek our culture without being doctrinaire, you know, without being dogmatic with it. We have to seek methods in our culture to resolve our issues. We can't seek these things from the Yoruba, from their system. Their system is diametrically opposed to our rise. It serves them that we are disunited. Believe me, you know, Dr. Amos Wilson paints this out very, very well. And so to seek those methods is to go into circles. We have to seek our own. We have to seek our own elders. But I believe that that is a starting point for solving some of the problems that plague our communities and to possibly heal it.
Ashe. Well, thank you, Brother Safo, for, you know, being open with us and allowing yourself to, you know, heal as a part of this process, and using your life as an example of how, you know, things can change for people, and how much more we have to still look forward to, even in your condition, staying positive. I know, you know, it couldn't always be easy, but here you are as a living testimony, you know, and like you said, some of our brothers might need to be in touch with, you know, you and more brothers like you. So, you know, all is not lost, Brother Safo. And again, if there's anything that we can do to help, to support you, to help get the pamphlet printed or anything like that, we're here for you. And don't be a stranger to Sign of the Times, okay?
Yes, I will, for sure. I appreciate this, Sister Vanessa. I really do. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. We'll be in touch soon, though. And if there's anything that comes up, please let us know. We're going to go ahead and sign off. Thank you, Brother Safo. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Yes, yes. Thank you. Salutes.
All right.
Kibuka.
This is Asafo Chuma Asafo reporting from Huntington State Prison in Pennsylvania. There's a growing disregard for freedom of speech for dissenting voices here in America, but especially so for Pennsylvania state prisoners, as many informative publications and periodicals are increasingly being denied by prison mailroom personnel. a lot of times out of personal bias. This includes personal family photos. On one occasion in particular, a photo of my small niece holding up the universal peace sign with her two fingers was arbitrarily deemed a gang sign. The photo was not allowed into the prison. Interestingly, white inmates who receive similar photos in the mail aren't put under the same scrutiny, leading me to believe that my photos are being racially profiled. I find it ironic, though hypocritical, that over 40 world leaders marched in a show of solidarity with the people of France in defense of freedom of speech and freedom of expression in the wake of the tragedy that claimed the lives of a dozen writers and cartoonists of the satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo. But here in America, the land of the free, those very same freedoms are under attack. Is freedom of speech only afforded to those who told the mainstream narrative? How do we grapple with the recently dethroned Governor Tom Corbett's Senate Bill 508, which was recently signed into law? These are questions that should concern us all. This is Asafo Chuma Asafo reporting from Huntington. I think we all should ask these questions about the infringement on our freedoms. This piece is called Capital by Safia Chuma Asafo, reporting from Pennsylvania Penitentiary at Huntington. As the world turns on its axis, spiraling backwards into a time and space held captive by the agents of avarice, we witness a 1% fraction shrug the entire atlas into eco disasters as the inglorious bastards of private practices divide the 99% masses into a caste of classes. With a grasp of fascist bandits, fashions antagonistic clashes between have-not helots and have-a-lot masters, landlords and the landless, whiteness against blackness, with the latter gagged and shackled and banished to the dark dungeons of the king's white castles. Entire lives are redacted from the planet's geographics as McCarthy's blacklist is reenacted under the guise of patriotic flagships and popular dissent is dumbed down to keeping up with the Kardashians. And to think, this ain't even the half of it. The rest of this madness will have to be viewed through 3D glasses, NSA spy tactics, and predator drone strike flashes, while the vampires of empire feed on the blood of the hapless. That is, until the Occupy movement is expanded and reimagined, and capitalism's last bastions is slain by the socialist dragon. And contrasted with Gil Scott-Heron's mantra, the revolution will be telecasted, and it will still be live. Zafir Chuma Asafo, reporting from Pennsylvania Penitentiary at Huntington.
Hello, this is a prepaid collect call from
Asafo,
an inmate at SCI Huntington. This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Huntington.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
To accept charges, press 1. To refuse charges, press thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
Yeah, greetings to all the warrior women out there. This is Asafo Chuma Asafo reporting to y'all live from this death camp, SCI Huntington, Pennsylvania, United States of America. This piece is called Who's That Woman? Who's That Woman? The quintessential sister, daughter, friend, wife, and mother figure. The matriarch. The African warrior queen, the protector and teacher of the young, the trustworthy, the loyal confidant, the one. Who's that woman? The doorway to heaven, the hellraiser, the love provider, the soul soother, the crazy lady, the freedom fighter. Who's that woman? The ride or die chick, the crybaby, the sexy soldier, the secrets keeper, the take no shit sister, the mind molder. Who's that woman? The balance, the earth, the vanguard, the three-fourths covered in garb, I got your back broad. The reliable, the revolutionary, the perfect partner, the round the way girl, the black pearl, the watcher. Who's that woman? The favorite aunt, the woman on a mission, the best in the war room, the bedroom, the boardroom, and the kitchen. The right man, the right hand to her man in the trenches. Who's that woman? The face of resilience, strength, and dignity. The soulmate, the playmate, the second self. The Winnie Mandela of the new millennium. In a single breath. Who's that woman? She is every woman committed to the struggle for the liberation of our people. Free the land. This is Asafo Chuma Asafo reporting for Huntington State Prison in Pennsylvania. I can't breathe within the solitary confinement of this police state environment. 11 times ignored cries until my freedom of speech went silent. I can't breathe, asphyxiated by mass incarceration, fixated on eradicating access to public education. I can't breathe beneath the weight of state-sanctioned hatred unleashed unabated onto a forsaken generation. I can't breathe, pepper sprayed and handcuffed, hands up in Ferguson, no weapons displayed, not enough, man down, a murdered son. I can't breathe, choking on the smoke and mirrors of corporate control, tele-eye vision, promoting hope and fairness in foisted grand jury decisions. I can't breathe, muzzled, incommunicado, wondering what Obama would say about prison hunger strikes and struggles from Cali to ADX, Colorado and Guantanamo Bay. I can't breathe, swallowed into the jaws of extrajudicial madness and waterboard tortures, shrouded under laws to suppress the much less fortunate. I can't breathe, entrapped within the narrow space of democracy's hypocrisies and probable causes liabilities, rewrapped in the hollow embrace of plutocracy's fallacies and plausible deniabilities. I can't breathe, smothered by lies, toy guns, and lost lives, 12 years a child, covered in guile, forked tongues, and racial profiles. I can't breathe because my dark hue causes a republic nuisance, arousing the ire of the agents of empire and their colorful stooges, publicly lynched till I expire by NYPD hands fashioned like nooses for the high crimes of bartering black market Lucy's. I can't breathe in fascist, racist, capitalist America. This is Asafo Chuma Asafo, reporting from Huntington.
Playback!
Here, hit it, now get it, partner. Right on, come on. What we reminisce for a spell, or shall I say think back 22 years ago to keep it on track.